about that.
All right, everybody. We are continuing our studies on the feasts, and we're going to be looking at the first official feast, I guess, now with Passover tonight. We're going to break this up into two classes, looking at the Passover. So Sunday morning, Daniel Grantham is going to be teaching some ideas about how the prophets will use the Passover imagery to talk about what the Messiah was going to do, which I think is going to further solidify why it matters that we study things like this, because these are pictures of what Jesus was going to do for us. And so, but today we're going to be looking kind of more at the Passover event in the book of Exodus and then drawing some parallels with Jesus in those ways. One other change to the schedule here. So we're here looking at the Passover Sunday. That's when Daniel's teaching. So I'm going to be in Las Vegas from the 1st to the 5th. There is a church there, and I'm doing a gospel.
Is it inside the casino?
Yeah, somewhere in there. They tucked it back here. The Feast of Booths was going to be on April 1st because the gospel meeting, there were some things that got mishmashed a little bit. I really wanted to teach the Feast of Booths, and I wasn't going to be able to because the gospel meeting dropped things down a little bit. So we are going to go out of order. The ones that have the asterisk, those were switched. So Purim and Hanukkah were going to be the last classes. But now it's going to be the Feast of Booths because I'm going to be back and I'll be able to do that. But then we got these that are going to kind of interrupt the flow of the seven feasts. I'm pretty sure nobody's going to be highly offended by that. So that's going to be the plan. Which I guess is kind of fitting because of the seven feasts, the Booths was the final one. And so that's how we can fit that together. Okay, so just as a reminder of what we've been looking at, the spring feasts, Passover, unleavened bread, first fruits. Today we're looking at Passover, but over the course of 8 days, you have Passover, unleavened bread, and first fruits. So they all kind of get clumped together, and there's going to be a lot of similarities between all of these things, but we're going to try to dissect out what are the differences between all of these things as we go through this. And let's just remind ourselves of a few things from this. Why is it the case that if the Israelites were told to travel 3 times a year for the feasts, but there's 7 feasts, why go 3 times a year?
Well, the feasts were clumped together, the 3 in the spring and the 3 in the fall.
Right, so
you could go and stay a little extra while.
Right, so in one trip you get 3 of the feasts, this trip you get 1 of them, so in 2 trips you have 4 of them done, and then in the 3rd trip you get the last 3. So they get clumped together, and so 3 trips is what allows you to get all 7 of these feasts accomplished. And, okay, so that's that. We've seen that. This is another chart just talking about the order of them. So today we're looking at Passover, and this is the Jewish Independence Day, and we'll see how that works as we go through this. All right, let's just remind ourselves of the purposes of the Jewish feasts. Why is it that God gave the Israelites these feasts? And maybe you could add more reasons to this than what we're talking about. But for what we're doing in these classes, remember, he gave them these feasts to remember what God had done in the past. Why does it matter that we remember what God has done?
Because he's faithful, and you can predict then that when he says something, it's going to be.
Right. Don't people say that history repeats itself? And so if you remember what God has done in the past, how he's delivered us and he's been there for us and stuff like that, then it would be lessons for how they can interpret the future and the fearful things that they're experiencing in the moment. So it's helpful in that way. You guys remember in Ezekiel 16, when the nation of Israel is described as this girl that was left on the side of the road, and God walked by her, and he said to her, live. So his words gave her life. That's what we need to study the Bible. And then she grew up, and she became beautiful, and God married her. And she became just absolutely gorgeous. So all the nations talked about her. All the people that would walk by her before when she was on the side of the road and a little child, nobody cared about her. Now that she's beautiful, people care about her. What does that do to her, though? What does she start to do?
She starts to forget.
She forgets. Yeah, she starts to commit spiritual adultery with all of the idols all around now that she's attractive. And in all of that, Ezekiel 16:22 says that you did not remember the days of your youth. So one of the things that God gave the nation to help them remember where they came from and what God had done for them were these seven feasts. Second reason was to create national unity, that when these people would come together and share in these things together, that it would help cultivate the unity of the nation as they knew that they came from the same heritage. And then finally, to foreshadow Christ, we're dealing a lot with that as we go through these classes. Let's just think about this other question from this last week. In what ways would we say that the Christians keep the Sabbath today? We talked about the Sabbath in the last class. So, in what way don't we keep the Sabbath today? Let's start with that question.
It's not a special day.
Yeah, it's not literally a special day of the week that we can't work and stuff like that. So, in what sense do Christians keep the Sabbath?
Remember what God's done for us.
Okay, remember when it's done. What else?
We enjoy the rest from sin that Christ has given us.
Right. Yeah, all of these, like the weekly observance of the Sabbath and all that, just like all the sacrifices that they'd be offering, all the animals that they would be slaughtering and stuff like this, all of this was helping them look forward to what the Messiah was going to do. It's no different with the Sabbath. The Sabbath was picturing how Jesus was going to give us rest from guilt, rest from the enslavement to sin, all of these sorts of things. And this concept of Sabbath gets kind of imported into all of the feasts. There's a sense in which all of the feasts relate to this idea of rest. Today we're looking at the Passover, which gave them rest from what?
Egyptian bondage.
Yeah, the bondage of Egypt. And so all of these feasts, in one way or another, are going to connect back to Sabbath, because Leviticus 23, that's the big chapter that deals with all of these feasts. What's the first holy convocation that it deals with in Leviticus 23? It's the Sabbath. And then from there it goes into the other things that we're talking about during these classes. One thing I forgot to bring up, by the way, you remember that the Old Testament was really vague about the instructions for the Sabbath. It was don't do any ordinary work, stuff like that. What did the Jews go ahead and do with the vagueness of the scriptures about those commands?
Made a large amount of specificity.
Yeah, they added a bunch of man-made laws to it. We got another chair right here. So what did the traditions that the Jews added to the Sabbath, what did that cause the Sabbath to become? A burden. And I think there could be a parallel application that when we add traditions to the Lord of the Sabbath, to Jesus, it makes Christianity become more of a burden than actually a blessing that it's supposed to be. It's another way of just showing a lesson that we already know, that traditions are dangerous. But it shows one of the reasons why. Okay. Anything else you guys want to say about these things by way of reminder? Alright, so tonight we're going to look at the actual event of the Passover, how the Jews were supposed to commemorate the Passover, and then how all of this looks forward to Jesus. And so that's what we're going to be looking at today. We're not going to be reading all of these texts. But let's just start out by talking about what's the context of the Passover event. So we know that they would commemorate the Passover every year, but it was commemorating this event that happened in Egypt that gave them deliverance. So you've got the Israelites being enslaved in Egypt. How did they get to Egypt in the first place?
Because of a famine that Joseph was there, had provided the grain. But
Joseph became the giver of bread, which is another way that he's looking forward to Jesus. And so the Pharaoh who had exalted Joseph to that position, Joseph dies. It looks like there's a new Pharaoh. There's some historical things about who those people may have been. And then the Israelites start growing and multiplying, and so the Pharaoh says to kill all the children and stuff. And all of this is associated with this harsh and bitter slavery that they had. I want you to notice Exodus chapter 4, verses 22 and 23. And this is after Moses has been commissioned by God at the burning bush to go ahead and go back to Pharaoh and warn him about something. But let's start in verse 21. And the Lord said to Moses, when you go back to Egypt, see that you do before Pharaoh all the miracles that I have put in your power, but I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my firstborn son, and I say to you, let my son go that he may serve me. If you refuse to let him go, behold, I will kill your firstborn son. In the Bible, God says in different... There's three different people in the Bible that are called like the God's firstborn son, or the firstborn from God. Anybody know who they are? They're the son of, I'm sorry, the son of God, or those kinds of phrases.
David.
What was that?
David.
Yeah, David. And the descendant that's going to come from David is going to be like a son to him. Who else? Adam. In the Gospel of Luke, he's called the son of God there. And this passage refers to the nation of Israel as God's firstborn son. What does that mean, that it's God's firstborn son? Does that mean there's the first nation that ever existed?
No, they're special.
Yeah. Yeah, these were the chosen people of God. And here's what's happening. Moses is going to go and try to get Pharaoh to let them go. Pharaoh's not going to let him do it. But there's going to be this trade-off, that this is God's firstborn son, and if you don't let them go, what's God going to do to Pharaoh's firstborn? He's going to have him killed. And so he gives him a series of 9 sermons or whatever, 9 warnings, letting him know that this is going to happen. This goes from Exodus chapter 7 to chapter 10. And the 10th plague is going to be the death of the firstborn because Pharaoh's not letting them go. So that's just the context of what we're looking at here. Leading up to the actual 10th plague, I want to notice a couple things about Exodus chapter 12. Look at, go over to Exodus chapter 12. And verses 1 through 13, these are giving us the instructions for the actual Passover moment. And then verses 14 through 20 are giving them instructions for how to commemorate it in the future. And so there's a few things that he tells them to do here. Like, look at verse, start in verse 2. This month shall be for you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year for you. Formerly it was what was now the 7th month. That used to be the first month of the year. This is like the religious first month of the year now. Look at verse 3. Tell the congregation of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, every man shall take a lamb according to their father's houses, a lamb for a household. What day was the lamb actually killed?
14th.
On the 14th day. But they take the lamb on what day?
15th.
On the 10th day. So they're taking the lamb. I'm going to have some speculation about that later, but I'm not going to make a big deal out of it. So they take it on the 10th day to get ready for the 10th plague. And what time are they supposed to actually kill the Passover lamb on the day of Passover? Twilight. What time is twilight?
Start of the Jewish day. 6 o'clock, isn't it?
Sundown.
Yeah, sundown.
Once in between the evenings.
Yeah. So, like, what time period could that be during the day? Just to help us imagine what's happening here. What's
6 o'clock.
Okay. When did the Jews say that the day ended? 6 o'clock. So if it's twilight, that means it's leading up to 6 o'clock, right? It's the time leading up to that because it's when the day is ending. And so they kill the lamb around that time. And what are they supposed to do with the blood of that lamb?
Put it on the lintels.
How are they supposed to put it on the lintels? Like, what are they supposed to use to paint it on there?
With
yeah,
leads?
Go down to verse 22. It says, take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in blood that is in the basin and touch the lintel and the 2 doorposts with the blood that is in the basin. None of you shall go out of the door of his house until the morning. All right, so I don't have a picture of the hyssop, but it's like this branch sort of thing that I guess can be used like a sponge of sorts. It's like a paintbrush almost. And so they would dip it into the basin where all the blood is, and then they'd put it on the lintels of the door to get ready for the angel of death to come. So they would do that. The next thing that they would do is they would have the meal. Look at verse 8. They shall eat the flesh that night, roasted on the fire with unleavened bread and bitter herbs, they shall eat it. All right, so there's 3 things that they're supposed to eat in this meal. What are those? What's the first one? Yeah, the meat. So they're eating the meat of the lamb, that sacrifice, and it's that very lamb that's also going to cause the angel of death to pass over. Okay, so what's the second thing that they eat? Unleavened bread. Why did they eat unleavened bread in the moment of Passover? I'm not talking about the commemoration of it. Why at the moment of the Passover did they have unleavened bread?
Because they were leaving so quickly.
Yeah, they didn't. It didn't have time for the dough to rise or whatever, so if they had to leave in haste. What's the third thing that they eat? Why would they eat bitter herbs? The Jews today, instead of having bitter herbs, you know what they have today? They substitute it with horseradish. That's what they consider their. So yeah, that's true. Yeah. So, but why the bitter herbs?
The bitterness of enslavement in Egypt.
Yeah. Look, go back to Exodus chapter 1, verse 14. So in Exodus 1:14, I'll actually start in verse 13, and notice all the words for work or service. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and all kinds of work in the field and all their work. They ruthlessly made them work as slaves. So Exodus begins by saying that Pharaoh made their work bitter. And so I think when they're eating this and as they commemorate it in days in the future, those would help them remember that there was some bitter times in all of this. Do you think that was important for them to have remembered the bitter herbs? Can you guys think of what happens in the book of Numbers shortly after they leave? What happens?
They want to go back because of the good food there.
Yeah, they have really good food there. Which I mean, San Diego, like all the food was grown there. Like in California, so all the food is like the best there. Like I understand, like leaving a place I'm not trashing Atlanta. But like the food was grown in California, so like it's the freshest food I've ever had. Like so, the Israelites, I guess, had really good food in Egypt, and they just kept remembering the good things about it. Part of the Passover event and the commemoration of it would have helped them remember, hey, the place that we came from, there were some really bitter things about that. And so you have to remember what God did in a positive kind of way, but it's also training them to remember how bad their former lifestyle was. That's another aspect of remembering that's going to be important in these feasts. Any comments or questions about that and the meal? Go down to verse 11 then. In this manner you shall eat it, with your belt fastened, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand, and you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. All right, so they're eating it like they're ready to go in case they just suddenly need to jump off from the table and start running. In the New Testament, when Jesus sends out the apostles, like in Mark 6, verse 8, he tells them to go with their belt fastened and to not take too many tunics and stuff like this. Some people have made connections that when Jesus is sending out the apostles to preach and teach in this way, it's very reminiscent and similar to the instructions on how they were supposed to eat the Passover, kind of signifying that there was a new Passover, there was a new deliverance that was going to happen. But those are just some things to say about the instructions on how they were supposed to get ready for what was about to happen. Does anybody have any comments or questions just about this stuff?
That would indicate quite a lot of faith in view of the failures of the previous failure.
What do you mean?
For them to be dressed and ready to move.
Oh, yeah.
This is going to work.
Yeah, yeah.
God says it is.
That's a good point. You've got these 9 plagues that has not softened Pharaoh's heart. And, like, this is going to be the one, I guess. And we've got to trust that God is actually going to make it happen here. So that's a good point. Okay, anything else just about that so far? We're driving towards some applications in all of this. So the 10th plague, the actual moment when this happens, notice a few things about this. The angel of death comes at midnight in verse 29, so they had eaten and some hours had passed or something. So look starting in verse 29. At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon. And all the first, by the way, who had formerly been in a dungeon?
Joseph.
Like, even the places where Joseph was, like, if you're a firstborn, you were dead. And all the firstborn of the livestock, and Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where someone was not dead. Then he summoned Moses and Aaron by night and said, up, go from among my people, both you and the people of Israel, and go serve the Lord as you have said. Take your flocks and your herds as you have said, and be gone and bless me also. Okay, so the angel of death, it indiscriminately is just killing all the firstborn. Why did the Israelites have to put the blood on the doors?
So it would pass over the day, not death angel pass over them.
What does that mean that the Israelites deserved?
Death.
The same thing that just happened to all of these people. Mm-hmm. And it was only by the sacrifice of the lamb that they were delivered from what they deserved to have happen to them, just like the rest of these people. Okay, so the angel of death does that. Every house had somebody that was dead. That would have been very frightening and scary. So there's all this crying and screaming. You can imagine that's happening. And for the moment anyways, Pharaoh changes his mind and lets them go. On their way out, so this plague finally works. This one does. On their way out, notice what happens in verses 35 and 36. The people of Israel had also done as Moses told them, for they had asked the Egyptians for silver and gold jewelry and for clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they let them have what they asked. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. Okay. What's ironic about them receiving all of this plunder after all of this work in Egypt?
They should have been paid for their work.
Yeah.
Their work.
It's almost like, okay, now you're kind of getting your payment, in a sense, for all this slavery. What do you think was later built with some of this material?
Golden calf.
I think the golden calf. What else could have been made from some of this?
The tabernacle.
Yeah, I think partially the tabernacle as well. Have you realized that when the Israelites leave Persia and they get to return home, what does Cyrus do for them?
He supplies what they need.
Yeah, he gives them all of this, like, material and gold and all of these things that Nebuchadnezzar had taken. He's given, like, all the money that they need to go build this thing. So it's almost like what Cyrus does is picturing, like, another kind of Passover, another kind of Exodus. And so these ideas are things that you're going to see in other places in the Bible as well. And then Daniel is going to talk more about that. All right, so they receive all this money for all of this. When they leave, look at verse 38. And a mixed multitude also went up with them, and very much livestock, both flocks and herds. What do you think it means that a mixed multitude came with them?
It wasn't purely the Jewish people.
Yeah. So who else would it have been?
Maybe Egyptian servants or something.
Yeah. Do you guys remember in one of the plagues, in Exodus chapter 9, there were some Egyptians that hid their livestock to protect them? During I'm trying to remember what plague it was. It was in chapter 9 with the hail. It says in chapter 9, verses 20 and 21, then whoever feared the word of the Lord among the servants of Pharaoh hurried his slaves and his livestock into the houses. But whoever did not pay attention to the word of the Lord, they left his slaves and his livestock in the field. So by the time you got to the seventh plague, some of the Egyptians, it looks like, had started to open up their heart to what God was doing and his power and the reality that he was greater than all the Egyptian gods. And so I think some of them left along with them. Okay, one other thing to say about this actual moment when they leave. Look at verse 39. And they baked unleavened cakes of dough that they had brought out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, because they were thrust out of Egypt and could not wait, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. Okay, so when they actually leave, what don't they have?
Yeast.
They don't have yeast. What else?
They don't have provisions for long term.
Yeah, they don't have long term provisions for what they're going to need. What's the festival after Passover? The week of unleavened bread. What is that commemorating? How God had taken care of them and provided for them? Can you imagine leaving and you're going into the wilderness and you don't have anything? Like, you haven't had time to prep. You haven't had time to pack, like, a camping bag with all this stuff that's neatly packed in there so that you can be out in the wilderness for a while. You don't have anything. And you're going out there. It reminds me of when Jesus would feed the multitudes people would be out with Jesus in the wilderness as he was preaching and teaching to them, and the disciples are saying, hey, we don't have anything to eat. Send them into their homes to go get, or send them into the villages to go get something to eat for themselves. And then Jesus is providing for them in those kinds of scenarios. Jesus is embodying and reenacting these kinds of things. And so you see some connections with Jesus in that as well. Okay, anything you guys want to add to that?
I did have a question. Why did he say bless me when he sent him out?
Yeah, I think he's finally seeing how powerful.
Maybe.
Yeah, but it only lasts a little. Yeah. I mean, it kind of seems like he's repenting, but it's only when something really bad has happened. And I think we see that same kind of thing today, that like people can go through a lot of hard things, and eventually they say, well, I kind of care about God right now, but it doesn't last very long. So, I don't know. Does anybody have any other thoughts on that?
It just seemed odd to me. I was noticing that.
I mean, clearly he needs some blessing right now.
Yeah,
there's no doubt. Okay, so that's the actual event of Passover. There's a ton of stuff that we didn't say about it, but I want to say a little bit more about how they were supposed to commemorate it every year. So that's the event. What was it that they were supposed to do every year? Go down to verse 15. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven out of your houses. For if anyone eats what is leavened from the first day until the seventh day, that person will be cut off from Israel. So this all begins with them being told to remove the leaven. Now the rest of it mainly is talking about the Feast of Unleavened Bread, so we're not going to talk much about that. But they were to begin all of this, before they even had the Passover meal, with removing all the leaven. You remember in Mark 14 when Jesus sends some of his apostles ahead of him to say, like, go prepare the Passover meal? What would be part of the process of preparing that?
Make sure there's no leaven in that.
Right. There's a lot of Jewish traditions where the Jewish fathers would, like, put little, like, pieces of bread around the house, and the kids are supposed to run around. It's like a game. They're supposed to go around and look for all the bread and get it all out of the house, which is picturing, like, the removal of sin and stuff like that. But we'll talk about that more next class.
Eric, yeah. Well, I'm in New York. There was a synagogue right around the corner, and I went out one day, and there was a fire truck out there in the side. I wondered what was going on, and I walked over, and they had a little fire out in front of the synagogue, and when I looked, it was bread, and they had a little fire that would get rid of all of it, and I realized it was Passover.
They were burning it?
Yeah, they were burning it. It was before Passover.
Right.
And it was loaf bread, like you buy in the grocery store.
Right.
And it was being burned, and the fire department was standing by there to be sure it didn't get out of hand.
Well, so you see, like, that tradition for the Jews to hide some of the bread in different places and stuff, that's pretty well-founded on what verse 15 is saying. When you guys do this, get all the leaven out of the house. Can you imagine being a little kid and you're growing up and dad is telling you, like, hey, this is the time of the year, like, we're about to have the Passover dinner tonight. Like, you guys scour the house and look for all the bread and get it out. Okay, again, you're doing this every year, and this is all looking forward to Jesus. What is this teaching you?
Yeah, remove the leaven, like Jesus taught.
Right.
Beware of the leaven.
Right.
The Pharisees.
And these are things that we have to eradicate. And now there's going to be other feasts where they do have bread with leaven in it. But the symbol in the New Testament becomes, this is something that we should never have in any part of us. And if the first thing that they do is they remove the leaven, and then what can they do? Then they can have the Passover meal. Doesn't this kind of sound like, okay, before you can partake of Jesus and what he's done for you and you can feast on him, what do you got to do first? You have to remove the leaven. You got to repent and be baptized. And so that's the process by which they would be able to partake in that. So then they eat it. There's some things about who can join later on in chapter 12. And who is it that can do, who can partake in this Passover?
Children of Israel.
Yeah, children of Israel. Who else?
Circumcised strangers.
Yeah, circumcised strangers and circumcised slaves. And so you think about the mixed multitude that came with them. Well, you can see why there's these instructions for these people, because we've got all kinds of people that are coming. How are we going to make sure that, like, what are we supposed to do for this mixed multitude that's come with us? Well, if they've been circumcised, they can also participate in these same things as they would remember it every year. Okay, so that's just the first part about the instruction for remembering. Anything else you guys want to say about that?
I apologize if I'm jumping ahead, but this differentiation between the foreigner who can't eat and the stranger who can eat because he's been circumcised, the language is a little bit confusing to us, but it's based, I mean, the foreigner, literally, it's son of a stranger. So it's not just somebody who's not an Israelite. It's somebody who refuses to be an Israelite.
Right.
They are like their father, a stranger to Israel.
Right.
And the sojourner, one who dwells among you and becomes like you by being circumcised, which means he's obeying the whole law, is allowed to partake. So that, I mean, even in the beginnings of the Jewish nation, it's not just being born into the right family. There is a real sense of commitment that is required in order to be a part of this fellowship.
Right.
And it's exactly the language that's picked up in the New Testament, exactly that concept that's carried forward.
Okay, very good. Good. Anything else? I want to spend a little time then. We've been going kind of at warp speed right now. I want to spend a little time about what the parents and children were supposed to do in all of this. So, look at chapter 12, verse 26. It says, "And when your children say to you, 'What do you mean by this service?' you shall say, 'It is the sacrifice of the Lord's Passover, for he passed over the houses of the people of Israel in Egypt, when he struck the Egyptians, but spared our houses.'" And the people bowed their heads in worship. Go over to chapter 13, verse 8. This is talking about unleavened bread. But in 13:8, "You shall tell your son on that day, 'It is because of what the Lord did for me.'" You notice how that's personal? So before it was, "This is what the Lord has done for our nation," sort of thing. But there's, in future generations, the fathers are supposed to tell their children, "It's what the Lord did for me. Well, I thought you weren't there when it happened." So how do you think about that? Like, why would they say that to the kids?
Well, they were descendants of the
Lord. Yeah, this is our heritage. This is what he did this for me too. And so he did this for me when I came out of Egypt. Look down at verse 14. "And when in time to come your son asks you, 'What does this mean?' you shall say to him, 'By a strong hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt from the house of slavery.'" So as your kids are getting older and older, as this commemoration is being thought of, there's going to be times where the kids are wondering, "Hey, why are we doing this? What's this all about?" What do you think would be a wrong way to tell a kid why we take the Lord's Supper every Sunday?
Church of Christ tradition.
Yeah, this is the Church of Christ tradition. This is what we do. Or to say, well, you know, this is kind of like just something that we're supposed to do when we get together. It has to be the unleavened bread. We have to make sure that it's that way, and we have to make sure that's the grape juice, because that's what the Bible says. There you go, right? What's the difference in what the parents are being told to tell their children here? What was that?
You have the form, but it's the reason why.
This is the reason why. Like, they're not just being told, like, here's a bunch of, like, strung-out arguments on why this is the right way to do what we're doing right now. And by the way, those pagan nations over there, they don't do the Passover because they're a bunch of pagans. He's saying, this is what the Lord did for us, and we're telling you a story. Timothy Keller, he had three new books come out yesterday, and I started reading one of them, and one of them has some things about parenting. And he says this about these kinds of passages. It says, "Notice that when children ask the big why question, as in, 'Why must we never lie, never steal, never commit adultery?' they are not to get a lecture on moral philosophy. They are given narratives, stories of struggles between good and evil that capture imaginations and shape hearts even more than arguments and propositions." What's the difference? You tell me, yeah. Abby?
Well, also, it's the focus, because if you start talking about, well, based on our understanding of these verses, this is what we've decided to do, and this is why we do, it's all about us and we and our thoughts. It's God did this.
Right.
And so we are drawing closer to Him. God has asked us to do these things, and because He has done so much for us, it changes your entire perspective. It's no longer about, again, our decisions as to why we do what we do. Everything is supposed to be focused on God, and our children should know that as well.
Right. I love that God, I mean, we got, you know, 3 kids now. I love that God is saying, this is how you talk to your kids about these things. Like, kids are asking, why do we go to church every week? Well, because we're commanded to in the Bible. Okay, that's true. And I think there's time and place to say that sort of thing. But could we give more narrative and story behind it that would help them understand that this is part of our heritage and what the Lord has done for us?
It's the difference between the what and the why.
Yes, yes. And I think both of them are important, but here these passages are saying, this is why we're doing these things, and so the kids can have something to sink their teeth into. So this brings up a question then, and let's discuss this for a little bit. Should Christians today look at these Old Testament stories as part of their heritage? How many of us are Jewish? So we're Gentiles.
My wife is.
Okay, so you're good.
My kids are good.
Yeah, you're proselyte. So like when the New Testament, like 1 Corinthians is writing to a church, was the church in Corinth made up of Jew or Gentile, or was it a mixed multitude? It was mixed. And then he talks about how our fathers passed through the Red Sea, and our fathers drank from the rock in the wilderness, and the rock was Christ. Interesting parallel with that. He had to strike the rock, and then the water came out. Jesus was struck, and then the blessings come out. And so, like, he's saying to this mixed church, this is our heritage. How, like, is it hard for us as Gentiles to look at these Old Testament stories and say, this is part of my story? I mean, for me, there's been, like, a disconnect in that because my heritage is, I'm from Norway. My last name is a city in Norway that nobody's ever heard of. So that's my people. I came to Ellis Island on all of the, like, in all the, like, this becomes our heritage, though. And so when we do talk about these 7 feasts that the Israelites had and the commemorations that they would do and stuff, this is our people because we are the real Israelites. We're the true Jew, like Galatians 6 and stuff would say. And I think that might have to, like, shape the way that maybe we would talk to other people about these Old Testament stories. Yeah, Abby?
And again, it's the focus. So for many Jews today, it's a cultural heritage. But it's, again, the focus is God is our heritage.
Yes.
So these were the people of God. We are the people of God. And so there is no difference. You know, this is our history. So if we can remove those cultural shades that all of us like to look at our histories from, it becomes a lot easier to see that connection.
Sure, that's good. Russ?
I think the children's classes here make a great deal of effort to try to accomplish this very thing.
That's good.
It may not be as well done as it can be, but they try very hard to connect Old to New Testament to show that this is all connected with one long story of God.
The timelines.
The connections of the periods, reviewing that. It's the reason why we spend a whole year on just the Old Testament stories in those children's classes, but not just as a discrete study, but a connected study back to this, because it is part of our heritage.
Right. Yeah, there's times where we're talking to Asher at home, and he, like, pulls out some Old Testament thing that I know that Samantha and I haven't discussed with him, but that's really cool. we're really blessed in those ways. But, like, so when we look at these feasts, why do they matter? These are our people. And this is what God did for our people. And I think studying these things help us make those connections more in our mind. And that was supposed to, like, the parents were supposed to teach the children in that. We don't have a ton of time. There's a few other things that I want to do with this.
So, can I just say one thing about that?
I guess.
The heritage thing. So I mean, we've celebrated Passover with Meredith's family before and gone through the whole ritual, reading all the books and asking the questions and reading the answers. And I'll just say it's very moving. Yeah, and partly for me it's moving because I see the incompleteness of that religious heritage. But it's also moving because if you as you begin to realize, as you're saying, that this is also our heritage, to be reminded in a very powerful, you know, almost physical way of what God has done in the past is very motivating.
Right.
Very, very helpful to building your faith. Not recommending that you need to go out and celebrate Passover, but just to say that clearly that was the point of it. It was,
right.
was to build that faith. And, you know, if you have a chance to read through the rituals or even to celebrate them, if you can do it in good conscience, I would take advantage of it because it's very powerful.
It is. And let's say a couple things about the traditions that the Jews added to this. I'm not going to say a lot about this. I'm going to zip through this so you guys can look up this if you want. But the Jews, there's four promises that God made to deliver the nation of Israel in Exodus 6. And in commemoration of those promises, the Jews would have four cups of wine that they would intersperse during the Passover meal. And people have tried to make some connections with when Jesus is drinking wine at the Lord's Supper, at the Last Supper, and stuff like that. The Jewish tradition has added several food items to the menu. Originally, it was three things. And so if you start reading all these Jewish traditions and stuff, it started out with the three things, and a lot has been added to it. But here's a tradition that's pretty well-founded. During the Passover week and the Passover meal, they would read Psalms 113 to 118. You see Jesus in the triumphal entry, them quoting some of these psalms. And after Jesus is done taking the Lord's Supper, the Last Supper, in Mark 14:26, it says, and when they had sung a hymn, they went out of the Mount of Olives. What's the last hymn that they would have sung during this meal?
Psalms 118.
Psalm 118. I want you to think about what Psalm 118 says as Jesus would be going out to the Mount of Olives. So here's what part of the last thing that they would say before he went out to be rejected by betrayed. It says, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This is the Lord's doing. Imagine 12 guys in the upper room singing this together. It is marvelous in our eyes. This is the day that the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. The Lord God, and he has made his light to shine upon us, bind the festal sacrifice with cords up to the horns of the altar. And then they go out to the Mount of Olives and he's betrayed. Pretty amazing. Like, of the traditions of Passover, this one is pretty clear. Like, I'm trying to be pretty careful in what traditions I bring up. This is a pretty well-founded one, though. Okay, so, anything you guys want to say about that? Okay, let me just zip through then some things with Jesus and the Passover and how he connects to all of this. Jesus is the spotless Lamb of God, Exodus 12, it has to be that way. 1 Peter 1 talks about that same idea. They had to eat all of the lamb, and if they didn't eat all of it, the rest of it had to be burned. Jesus, when he feeds the multitude in John chapter 6, it's on Passover when he does this. He says later in the chapter, you have to eat his flesh and drink his blood. The drinking of the blood would have gone against Old Testament kinds of practices, but he's being very vivid here about eating him. And it's on Passover that he's talking about that. Another parallel, the use of hyssop. They would use that to do the lintels. When Jesus was on the cross, they took the sour wine and they put a sponge full of sour wine on a hyssop branch and held it to his mouth. That's an interesting parallel there. No bones were broken, and that was told in Exodus 12:46. John makes a big deal that his bones were not broken when he was on the cross. He died early, so they didn't have to crack him, so he couldn't lift himself up to avoid asphyxiation. Anything you guys want to add to that? I'm sorry, I'm just going really fast right now. Yeah.
With reference to the hyssop. Moses sprinkled the book of the covenant with the blood from a hyssop branch.
Yes.
So the blood instituting the covenant.
Yes.
The same thing would be true.
That's right. And on Psalm 51, David talks about purge me with hyssop. Like, this is a picture of purging and cleansing and stuff like that. Okay. 1 Corinthians 5, 7 and 8. Cleanse out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, as you really are unleavened. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Let us, a church made up of Jew and Gentile, let us therefore celebrate the festival, not with the old leaven, the leaven of malice and evil, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Let's celebrate it in a new way together in Christ because of what he's done for us. But not literally keeping the calendar, right? These are all foreshadows. For like the 10 seconds that we have, do you guys have any other ideas on what parallels between Passover and Jesus that you guys have thought of?
I had one thought about how the Passover is about two things at once, delivering God's people and also condemning the Egyptians.
Yes.
And how Jesus also separates the wheat and the chaff, so to speak, you know, delivering those who would follow and condemning the rest. So.
And what Jesus did, he condemned sin, Satan, and death. Like, he's defeated right. that. But then there's also the judgment as well. That's right. That's good. Any other parallels that you guys can think of between Jesus and the Passover?
Oh, it was taken just before the deliverance, and then as a memorial. And Jesus then excused the Lord's
yes.
Supper just before the sacrifice.
That's good.
To continue the memorial.
And that's what we do in the Lord's Supper. I forgot to mention Exodus 12:3, how they select the lamb on the 10th day. Depending on how you look at the calendar, the week when Jesus enters Jerusalem, it may have been the 10th day when he enters into Jerusalem. And some people have said that the reason that they pick it on the 10th day is so that they can inspect the lamb to make sure it's unblemished. But my question for that is, why would they pick it to begin with if it wasn't unblemished? I don't know. That part of that is Jewish tradition. And so after Jesus enters Jerusalem, what do the Jewish leaders do? They start inspecting him, trying to find fault with him, and they can't find any fault with him. And then Pontius Pilate declares several times that, I don't see any fault with this guy. And so maybe that parallels the 10th day where they select the lamb, and then a few days later it gets killed. And so I'm not sure about that one. That requires a little bit more speculation than the other parallels. So, did the other bell ring?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. All right.